Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. Former special counsel in the Joe Biden classified documents investigation, Robert Hur, testifies before the House Judiciary Committee defending to Republican members his decision not to recommend charges against President Joe Biden when charges have been brought against former President Donald Trump for mishandling classified documents, and to Democratic members his decision against charges because the president's memory lapses would make him sympathetic to a jury. Robert Hur told the committee partisan politics had no place whatsoever in my work. President Biden meets at the White House with the president and prime minister of Poland, who are pushing for more aid to Ukraine to help that country in its war with Russia on this 25th anniversary of Poland joining NATO. As at least two efforts have emerged on Capitol Hill to bypass House Speaker Mike Johnson and bring a bill providing more aid to Ukraine up for a vote. FBI Director Christopher Wray warned of an increased terror threat from some migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. The Biden administration welcomes the news that Haiti's prime minister will resign, paving the way for a transitional government and international peacekeeping force to restore order from the widespread gang violence. That force will be led by Kenya. On Capitol Hill, debate on a bill to require federal buildings that are not being used enough by federal workers, many of whom are teleworking, to be sold or have their leases canceled. And Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor tells of an early civics experience at a Civic Learning Week forum. From Associated Press, lawmakers turned a Tuesday hearing on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents into a proxy battle between the Democratic president and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, as a newly released transcript of Biden's testimony last fall showed that he repeatedly insisted he never meant to retain classified information after he left the vice presidency. Special Counsel Robert Hur, testifying before the House Judiciary Committee, stood steadfastly by the assessments in his 345-page report that questioned Biden's age and mental competence but recommended no criminal charges. That from Associated Press. Robert Hur testified as a private citizen. His position as special counsel ended yesterday. In his opening statement to the committee, he defended saying in his report that a jury would likely see President Biden as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. These are the types of issues that prosecutors analyze every day. And because these issues were important to my ultimate decision, I had to include a discussion of them in my report to the Attorney General. The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue. We interviewed the president and asked him about his recorded statement, quote, "I just found all the classified stuff downstairs," end quote. He told us that he didn't remember saying that to his ghostwriter. He also said he didn't remember finding any classified material in his home after his vice presidency. And he didn't remember anything about how classified documents about Afghanistan made their way into his garage. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do. I took the same approach when I compared the evidence regarding President Biden to the department's allegations against former President Trump. There, too, I called it like I saw it. As a prosecutor, I had to consider relevant precedents and to explain why different facts justify different outcomes. That is what I did in my report. I'm confident the analysis set forth in chapters 11, 12, and 13 of my report provides a thorough evaluation and explanation of the evidence, and I encourage everyone to read it to inform their opinions of the report.
Robert Hur, former special counsel in the President Biden classified documents investigation, part of his opening statement today before the House Judiciary Committee. Again, from the Associated Press article, the hearing played out as both Joe Biden and Donald Trump were on the cusp of claiming their party's nominations, and the party lines calcified almost immediately over which leader meant to hang on to classified documents, or rather who willfully retained them and who didn't. Republicans argued Biden was being given a pass by his own Justice Department and that Trump had been unfairly victimized by prosecutors. Democrats, for their part, stressed Biden's cooperation in the investigation and strongly contrasted that with a separate criminal case against Trump, who refused to return classified documents requested by the National Archives that he had at his Florida estate. Again, that was from Associated Press. More from the hearing. Here's the House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, asking Robert Herr about President Biden's motives.
So Joe Biden knew the rules. You know he knew the rules. And Joe Biden told us he knew the rules. So, Mr. Herr, why did he break them?
Congressman, the conclusion as to exactly why the president did what he did is not one that we explicitly address in the report. The report explains my decision to the attorney general that no criminal charges were warranted in this matter.
I think you did tell us. I think you told us, Mr. Herr. Page 231, you said this. President Biden had strong motivations. That's a key word. We're getting to motive now. President Biden had strong motivations to ignore the proper procedures for safeguarding the classified information in his notebooks. Why did he have strong motivations? Because, next word, because he decided months before leaving office to write a book. To write a book. That was his motive. He knew the rules. He broke them because he was writing a book. And you further say, and he began meeting with the ghostwriter while he was still vice president. There's the motive. Mr. Herr, how much did President Biden get paid for his book?
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure if that information appears in the report.
Sure does. There's a dollar amount in there. You remember?
It may be $8 million.
$8 million. Joe Biden had 8 million reasons to break the rules. Took classified information and shared it with the guy who was writing the book. That's why he did. He knew the rules, but he broke them for $8 million in a book advance. But you know what? It wasn't just the money. Joe Biden, here's this page 231, very next page. Joe Biden, in your report, Joe Biden viewed his notebooks as an irreplaceable, contemporaneous record of the most important moments of his vice presidency. He'd written this all down for the book, for the $8 million. And the next thing you say in your report is, quote, such a record would buttress his legacy as a world leader. You know what this is? It wasn't just the money. It wasn't just $8 million. It was also his ego.
Congressman Jim Jordan, chair of the Judiciary Committee, Republican from Ohio, questioning former special counsel Robert Herr at today's hearing. Robert Herr was principal associate deputy attorney general in the Trump administration and was appointed by former President Trump to be U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland. Today, Congressman Hank Johnson, Democrat from Georgia, asked Robert Herr whether politics played a role in his investigation and report on President Biden's handling of classified documents.
Despite clearing President Biden from being prosecuted, you used your report to trash and smear President Biden because he said in response to questions over a five-hour interview that he didn't recall how he got the documents. And you knew that that would play into the Republicans' narrative that the president is unfit for office because he's senile. And the American people saw during the State of the Union address that that was not true. But yet that's what you tried to offer to them, and that's why they are having you here today, so that they can expand upon that narrative. And you knew that that's what was going to happen, didn't you?
Congressman, I reject the suggestions made.
Let me move on.
Partisan
then,
politics
You are a member of the Federalist Society, are you not?
And fair.
Are you a member of the Federalist Society?
I am not a member of the Federalist Society.
But you are a Republican, though, aren't you?
I am a registered Republican.
Yes, sir. And you're doing everything you can do to get President Trump reelected so that you can get appointed as a federal judge or perhaps to another position in the Department of Justice. Isn't that correct?
Congressman, I have no such aspirations, I can assure you, and I can tell you that partisan politics had no place whatsoever in my work. It had no place in the investigative steps that I took. It had no place in the decision that I made, and it had no place in a single word of my report.
Former Special Counsel Robert Hur, questioned by Congressman Hank Johnson, Democrat from Georgia. You can find the full House Judiciary Committee hearing at cspan.org. Our video library runs a little over 4 hours. One more note from it. This from The Hill. Democrats on Tuesday sought to turn the tables on Republicans who zeroed in on Special Counsel Robert Hur's commentary on President Biden's memory, turning repeatedly to video clips of former President Trump mangling words, mixing up individuals, or forgetting details. And before the hearing, a transcript of Robert Hur's 5-hour interview with President Biden was released. Axios writes that President Biden repeatedly mixed up dates, countries, and the timeline of significant events, including the years his son Beau died and Donald Trump was elected. After the report was released, Biden disputed Hur's statement that he didn't remember the year his son Beau Biden died. He said, in February, when I was asked the question, I thought to myself, it wasn't any of their damn business. But the transcript showed that Biden himself brought up his son, not her, and that he did have trouble recalling that Beau died in 2015 until White House lawyer Rachel Cotton helped. That was the reporting from Axios as the transcript was reviewed by that news organization and many others. This is Washington Today. President Joe Biden today hosting Poland's president and prime minister for White House talks. Associated Press says that they are looking to press Washington to break its impasse over replenishing funds for Ukraine at a critical moment in the war in Europe, and that ahead of the visit, President Andrzej Duda called on other members of the NATO alliance to raise their spending on defense to 3% of their GDP as Russia puts its own economy on a war footing and pushes forward with its plans to conquer Ukraine. Poland already spends 4% of its own economic output on defense, double the current target of 2% in NATO. That was from Associated Press. President Biden invited Duda and the Polish president because today is the 25th anniversary of Poland joining NATO.
Mr. President, Mr. Prime Minister, it's an honor to welcome you to the historic anniversary. It's kind of interesting. 25 years ago today, it was this very day, Poland joined NATO, and some of you may remember I was very involved in that happening. And during that ceremony, the former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, made this following statement. She said, "When we stand together, no force on earth is more powerful. We stand together, no force on earth is more powerful." I believe that then, and I believe it now. And we see it in Polish-American troops serving side by side NATO on the Eastern Flank, including in Poland. And we see it in our commitment to strengthen NATO's collective defenses. And I want to pause here and note that Poland is spending nearly 4% of its gross domestic product on defense, much of it purchasing American weapon systems and aircraft. And that's double the NATO commitment, 4%. We also see it in our support for Ukraine and the force of Putin's vicious onslaught against Ukraine in a way that is just border. I won't even describe it. And I want to thank you both for Poland's unwavering security and humanitarian assistance, including welcoming about 1 million Ukrainian refugees. As my mother would say, God love you. You're doing God's work. You really are. It's incredible what you're doing, what the Polish people are doing. Today, the United States is announcing an emergency package for Ukraine using cost savings from previously approved Pentagon contracts. The package includes munitions and rounds to help Ukraine hold the line against Russia's brutal attacks for the next couple weeks, which I have the authority to do without asking Congress for some more money right now. But I've asked them for a lot more money. And but it's not nearly enough what I'm announcing today. Congress must pass the bipartisan national security bill now, which includes urgent funding for Ukraine. We must act before it literally is too late, before it's too late. Because as Poland remembers, Russia won't stop at Ukraine. Putin will keep going, putting Europe, the United States, and the entire free world at risk, in my view.
President Biden with the President and Prime Minister of Poland today at the White House. Guardian newspaper explains that the Pentagon will rush about $300 million in weapons to Ukraine after finding some cost savings in its contracts, even though the military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish all the weapons it has pulled from its stocks to help Kyiv in its desperate fight against Russia, the White House announced Tuesday. And this from the Wall Street Journal, House Democrats moved to force a vote on a $95.3 billion aid package focused on Ukraine and Israel, as impatience with Speaker Mike Johnson prompted them to seize on a rarely used parliamentary tactic that could enable them to circumvent Republican leadership. The bill passed the Democratic-run Senate last month and hasn't moved in the House. House Democratic leaders told rank-and-file lawmakers that they would begin accepting signatures on a so-called discharge petition Tuesday morning. The petition allows rank-and-file members to bypass House leaders and put legislation directly on the floor, provided they can collect 218 signatures or a majority of the seats in the House. That was from the Wall Street Journal. Congressman Pete Aguilar, the House Democratic caucus leader, spoke about this at a news conference.
The fastest way is for the Speaker to put this on the floor. This has the National Security Supplemental that passed in the Senate, bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans. To put that on the president's desk, we need to pass the Senate version. Rosa DeLauro, Jim McGovern went to the floor, I believe an hour ago, to turn our discharge on. So it is now live, so we can collect signatures for the National Security Supplemental. Rosa DeLauro has indicated that she will... That will be the Senate language. So what we are asking our colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, is to sign the discharge petition that will bring to the floor the Senate National Security Bipartisan Supplemental. That is the fastest and easiest way to solve this issue, to provide the relief that Jason Crow discussed.
The House Democratic Caucus Leader Pete Aguilar of California at a news conference with other House Democrats, including Jason Crow of Colorado, and mentioned that discharge petition being led by Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, ranking member on the Appropriations Committee, and Jim McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts, ranking member on the Rules Committee. Congressman Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, spoke to reporters today about their bill to provide aid to Ukraine, as well as Israel and Taiwan. It totals $66 billion, lower than the $95 billion in the Senate-passed bill. And the Problem Solvers bill also includes border security policies. Congressman Bacon says they're gearing up for a discharge petition of their own.
Has the Speaker been as explicit with you all in conference settings, telling Republicans don't support this? Because he's been saying it publicly, but I'm curious if
he could ever say support a discharge petition. Yeah. But in the end, our bill addresses every concern he has. I think it's the best bill that we have. It's not meant to be the only bill that will ever pass on these subjects, but it does remain in Mexico and Title 42 without the pandemic language. It has military aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It's 30% less than the Senate version. So I feel like it's the best bill we have. I do think it will be modified because I think Mike McCall would like to... add some stuff, but that's all right. Our goal is to kick in the door and try to get something done.
But just to confirm, you're not changing the underlying bill. You're just setting up, you know, thinking about amendment
votes. Mike McCall may modify it if that's what it takes to get on the floor. He's the foreign affairs guy. And if he can modify it in a way that will help get us 218 votes, I'm not going to resist it.
How urgent is it?
It's urgent. Ukraine is rationing shells. I've talked to the Israelis. They need the aid too right now. In fact, as Taiwan needs it, we need a deterrence in Taiwan. They want a war with China, and Taiwan is a day too late. We got to get stuff there now.
Do you know when the petition's going to open up for signatures?
Yeah, it's open up this week.
And then are you actively having conversations with your colleagues, encouraging them to support this?
Yeah, I am, but I want to give credit to Fitzpatrick. He's really working that side hard.
Can you describe your conversations with Speaker Johnson about this?
You know, there's concern that there's about 70 Republicans who will probably oppose this.
How many?
But I would point out 70. But I would point out 150 will support it. And that's a good number because we'll get 100 Democrats. I mean, we need to get 218. And it's going to be in the middle. We're going to lose people on the ends.
He expressed concerns to you about losing members on this.
Yeah.
Did he ask you to stop?
No.
Okay.
Jeffries, though, is still pushing.
Well, I did ask. I don't think he's encouraging me either.
Jeffries is still pushing for the Senate bill. So what makes you think the Democratic...
It's DOA. He'll never get on the floor. And you got to have remain in Mexico, or we're going to have to do some kind of border security policy. And it's $95 billion, and I think our side of the aisle feels like that's too much money.
How close are you to getting this onto the floor?
We got to work the discharge part of this, which starts this week.
Congressman Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska and a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, speaking to reporters outside the House Republican Conference meeting. And he referred to Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania. Some of the Democrats supporting this bill include Jared Golden of Maine, Ed Case of Hawaii, and Marie Glusenkamp Perez of Washington State. The House Republican majority is about to get a bit smaller. Congressman Ken Buck, Republican of Colorado, who announced last fall that he wouldn't run for re-election this year, announced today, "I will depart Congress at the end of next week." That would be March 22nd. On Russia's war in Ukraine, this story from BBC News, three Ukrainian-based Russian paramilitary groups say they've crossed into Russia and are now fighting government troops there. The Freedom of Russia Legion and the Siberian Battalion posted videos reportedly showing their fighters in Russia's Belgorod and Kursk regions. Russia's defense ministry said the breakthrough attempts were thwarted. Ukraine's military denied any involvement in Tuesday's cross-border raids. That was from BBC News. About U.S. border security, the FBI Director Christopher Wray asked today at a hearing of the House Intelligence Committee about his comments yesterday at the Senate Intelligence Committee, as Newsmax reported it, that he's concerned illegal migrants entering the U.S. at the southern border could produce another 9/11 terrorist attack. Here's the question from the committee chair, Michael Turner, Republican from Ohio.
Director Wray, you have been very public over the past several months, and including yesterday in the worldwide threats hearing in front of the Senate, on warning of a potential terrorist attack occurring in the United States. The intelligence that we see is clear, and I appreciate that you have publicly entered into the discussion of the threat and the concern that we are currently facing. People who want to do America harm have entered our country illegally and are here. Now, you have continued to cite that warning, and I'd like your comments on, you believe that we are at a significant risk right now here from the possibility of a terrorist attack.
I believe that the terrorist threat level that we're contending with right now is at a whole nother level from an already heightened terrorist threat level that we were seeing even before October 7th. And I say that for a variety of reasons. First, you've seen a veritable rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations calling for terrorist attacks against us in a way that we haven't seen in a long, long time. And these are terrorist organizations, as this committee knows very well, which often don't see eye to eye on much, but they seem to see eye to eye on this. I would add to that that we are very concerned about the risk of inspired attacks, lone actors here, inspired by some of those same calls for violence from over in the Middle East. And so this is a time not for panic, but for heightened vigilance given the risk.
The FBI Director Christopher Wray at the House Intelligence Committee hearing. The questions coming from the chair, Michael Turner, Republican from Ohio, also testifying today. And as the chair mentioned, they testified yesterday before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the heads of the CIA, the DIA, Cyber Command, and the Director of National Intelligence. Story from Politico, President Joe Biden will consider conditioning military aid to Israel if the country moves forward with a large-scale invasion of Rafah, according to four U.S. officials with knowledge of internal administration thinking. Biden's openness to taking this step reflects the extreme strains in his relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has rejected subtler efforts by the Biden administration to rein in his conduct of the war with Hamas. That was from Politico. The U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan asked about this at today's White House briefing.
If Israel moves forward with the Rafah operation without having contingencies in place to ensure what you guys believe is adequate safety for civilians, would the White House send any sort of conditionality on further aid?
So I've read these reports. They're based on uninformed speculation by anonymous officials. I'm not going to comment on hypotheticals. The president has been very clear about our position on Rafah, and our position is that a military operation in Rafah that does not protect civilians, that cuts off the main arteries of humanitarian assistance and that places enormous pressure on the Israel-Egypt border is not something that he can support. We are talking to the Israelis about that. We are working through it, and I'm not going to stand at this podium and entertain hypotheticals on it. Yeah.
Just on that question, on that issue, the president did say over the weekend that if Israel forces were to go into Rafah, that that would be a crossing of a red line. I'm just wondering, what would the Biden administration do if that did come to fruition and Israeli forces did go into Rafah?
I would just note, having been around a little while, that I know all of you are obsessed with this concept of the red line. The president didn't make any declarations or pronouncements or announcements. The red line came up in a question. He was responding to that question. I think he gave a full answer to it. I think it's worth going back and reading his full answer to that question. And he answered it completely, so I've got nothing to add to what he said. And again, as I said to the earlier question, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. We've made clear our concerns about an operation in Rafah. We've made clear our concerns about the fact that an operation would put an enormous number of civilians at risk, and we have not seen a credible plan to protect those civilians. That is the position the United States has set forward. We've been clear about it. We've been principled about it. We're engaged with the Israeli government about our concerns, and again, I'm not going to entertain hypotheticals.
Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, in the White House briefing room. Reuters reporting that Haiti's prime minister, stranded in Puerto Rico as gang violence sweeps across his country, said on Monday night he'll resign as soon as a transition council and a temporary leader are chosen. But it was not clear when this might happen as the security situation in the capital deteriorates and plans for the deployment of an international mission to restore order run into problems. More than 8,400 people were reported killed, injured, or kidnapped in Haiti in 2023, more than double the number reported the year before. The gangs continue to fight over territory and are estimated to control up to 80% of Port-au-Prince. That's some of the reporting from Reuters. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller talked about this development at the top of his news conference.
We welcome yesterday's announcement of a transitional governance structure in Haiti, which paves the way for a peaceful transition of power, continuity of governance, an action plan for near-term security, including the deployment of a multinational security support mission, and a pathway to free and fair elections. We commend Prime Minister Henri for his statesmanship in putting his country first and agreeing to step down when the transitional presidential council is established. His decision comes at a critical point for the Haitian people. The Secretary also thanks our international partners, Brazil, Canada, Mexico, France, and the UN for facilitating and supporting the meeting. During the meeting, Secretary Blinken announced an additional $33 million in humanitarian assistance for the people of Haiti, as well as an additional $100 million for the multinational security support mission. These are important first steps to achieving free and fair elections and providing the peace and security the Haitian people deserve. We recognize there is a great deal of work that remains to be done, and the United States is committed to continuing to support the people of Haiti. With that, Matt.
Okay, thank you. So when exactly is this transitional council going to be formed?
So under the terms of the agreement that was announced yesterday, we expect that the members of the transitional council will be appointed in the next 24 to 48 hours. And then they will take the step to appoint an interim prime minister in the near future after that.
So when will Henri actually resign?
Our expectation is that he would resign upon appointment of an interim prime minister. So the transitional council will be appointed first, then they will deliberate and appoint an interim prime minister. He would remain the prime minister until such point as there is an interim prime minister who takes the position.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller, questioned by Associated Press reporter Matthew Lee at today's briefing in Washington. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Monday at the meeting in Jamaica of Caribbean states that the U.S. will contribute $300 million to the multinational security mission in Haiti that will be led by Kenya. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach, so no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you find your podcasts. TheHill.com reports that Shalonda Young, director of the Office of Management and Budget, slated to testify Tuesday morning in front of the Senate Budget Committee regarding President Biden's 2025 budget request, fielding questions from lawmakers. The president rolled out his sweeping $7.3 trillion budget request on Monday with a set of ambitious proposals aimed at raising taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations. In his annual budget plan, the president calls for trimming the nation's deficits by $3 trillion in the next 10 years while doubling down on pitches to increase the corporate tax rate, enact a minimum tax on billionaires, quadruple the stock buybacks tax, and other measures. That was from The Hill. C-SPAN covered today's hearing. Here is Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, asking Director Young about budget deficits.
Ms. Young, do you know what a dollar that you held at the start of the Biden administration is worth today?
I'm sure you'll let me know, Senator.
Well, it is a number you should know. It's worth 85 cents. That is driving an awful lot of the numbers on your budget here. It's causing an awful lot of pain for the American public. I want to kind of pick up where Senator Scott left off without really asking questions. But you take a look at what we were spending prior to the pandemic, about $4.4 trillion. I personally think in 2020 we spent too much. You know, we started talking about the CARES Act. It was about $750 billion within a few weeks. That was, you know, up to $2.2 trillion. It wasn't money spent very efficiently. But I think we had to do something fast. We had to do something massive so that markets wouldn't collapse. But after 2020, you know, we had, because we spent another $2 trillion in 2020, we had so much money sloshing around the economy. At most, I think we were down 25 million jobs for a few months. Within a few months, we were up to about 8 million job losses. But come January 2021, again, so much money sloshing around, there's so much pent-up demand, those jobs are going to be coming back relatively soon. What do you think sparked the 40-year high inflation?
Senator, we can also talk about inflation that has come down by two-thirds.
No, and again, that and, damage and is done. What sparked 40-year high inflation?
Most economists agree that coming out of a global pandemic, which is why we saw inflation across every major economy in this country, it was the supply chain issues, economies turning back on coming out of a once-in-a-generation pandemic, which is why you saw inflation across the globe increase.
I mean, you don't think that too many dollars chasing too few goods is the primary cause of inflation? And when you spend $2 trillion one year over the next, and then you don't readjust the baseline. I mean, how can you justify spending $4.4 trillion? As Senator Scott was saying, population grew less than 2% over this time frame. So we go from $4.4 trillion to $6.5. 2021, when President Biden comes into office, we spent $6.8. And then 6.3. We haven't reset to the 2019 baseline. How are we ever going to recover from this?
Senator, we put forth a proposal, a way to continue to invest in the American people. If we think we have adequate child care and paid leave in this country, I welcome us to talk to hardworking Americans. We can do that by asking the top 1% and 2% to add more into the system. That way, we can not only pay for our investments, but we can bring down the deficit over $3 trillion. We can't just talk about spending as if it only hits those programs that hit working families in this country.
I think it's a fantasy. If you make the rich pay their fair share, and by the way, the top 1% garner about 20% of the income, pay about 40% of the income tax. I mean, at some point in time, you have to say, well, that's probably a pretty fair share.
Well, okay? If you had sales double tax income and local tax, they pay about 25%.
But you know, I remember when a couple hundred billion dollars was like real money. You know, the political process would be all upset if you're running a couple hundred billion dollar year deficit. Your plan to get us out of this, you're running deficits of 1.8, 1.5, 1.5, 1.5, 1.5, 1.6, 1.5. It never comes down. You know, you're basically locking in at least $1.5 trillion deficits for the next 10 years. That's what you're budgeting. I mean, clearly, this is unsustainable. You don't worry about, once again, sparking massive inflation that further devalues the dollar from a dollar to 85. What is going to go down to 70 to 60?
The Senator, absolutely. That is why we put forth a plan that would actually bring deficits down by $3 trillion. We care about our fiscal path. This president has shown how you can still invest in American people and achieve deficit reduction. And by the way, he worked with Republicans to sign a fiscal responsibility act that would save $1 trillion on our deficit.
Shalanda Young is the White House Budget Director, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, testifying before the Senate Budget Committee on the president's fiscal year 2025 budget request. The question's coming from Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. Story from Federal News Network, the Biden administration sees a major opportunity to shrink the federal government's sprawling real estate footprint and is making the project a top priority in its fiscal 2025 budget proposal. The White House, in the plan released Monday, proposes giving the federal government's landlord, the General Services Administration, $425 million to right-size the federal footprint and reduce long-term costs through a new optimization program. The White House budget plan also calls for giving GSA broadened authorities related to the disposal of excess property. That was from Federal News Network. The U.S. House Republican majority taking a different approach, passing a bill today requiring OMB and GSA to reduce or consolidate federally owned or leased workspace if the utilization rate falls below 60%. Congressman Scott Perry, Republican of Pennsylvania, spoke in favor of the bill on the House floor.
A recent Government Accountability Office review of how agencies were actually using their headquarters space here in Washington, D.C., found that 17 of 24 agencies the GAO reviewed used 25% or less of their space. 17 of 24, 25% or less of their space. One agency even admitted that if 100% of their employees showed up, every single one of them showed up, they would still only use 67% of their own building. Even more troubling is some agencies were using only 9%. They can't even make double digits of their space, 9%. And to be clear, we're not just paying for space to sit empty, but throughout the whole time, we're paying for utilities and services such as heating, cooling, lighting, regular power, maintenance, security, for the entire space that no one is in. Empty federal buildings are not only a drain to the federal taxpayer, but they also don't produce investments needed for local economies because nobody's in the building. There's nobody there to go out to lunch. The bottom line is agencies should bring federal workers back to the office. But the reality is underutilized space has been a chronic problem in federal real estate and is one reason federal property has been on the GAO's high-risk list since 2003. So this is 20 years on now that this problem has been identified and remains existing.
Congressman Scott Perry, Republican from Pennsylvania, on the House floor. Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat from Virginia, opposed the bill and offered an amendment to count federal workers who telework as occupying the building space.
GSA already assists agencies with consolidating unused spaces. If you take out the bill language that matches what GSA is already doing, it's easy to read this as just a partisan ploy to move agency headquarters out of the National Capital Region and attack federal employees. There's no need to introduce the bill to mandate work that GSA already does. and to threaten to remove agency workspaces because of arbitrary building occupancy rates. Madam Speaker, I've invested in managed real estate for many decades. This bill doesn't offer an appropriate metric to evaluate space usage, need, or work productivity. I didn't consider places in my car stores that were occupied by cars instead of people as wasted space. It's a matter of appropriateness. Any member here who would allow their staff to work from home would be a hypocrite to oppose this bill. We need the best and brightest to want to work for the federal government, and we want to utilize telework and non-traditional hours or days where it's appropriate. After all, we want the most productive and effective federal workforce, and implying a 1950s mentality of butts in seats 5 days a week doesn't reflect the actual work that most Americans do. What if they need to spend every day in a SCIF or at a site visit? And for these reasons, at the appropriate time, I'll offer a motion to recommit this bill back to committee. If House rules had permitted, I would have offered the motion with an important amendment to this bill offered by Representative Titus. This amendment would assure that all federal employees, including ones using alternative work schedules, are counted for utilization rates of federal buildings. This amendment would significantly alleviate some concerns coming from workers who use alternative work schedules and whose access to reliable workspaces would be threatened by this bill.
Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat from Virginia, his motion to recommit failed, and then the original bill passed by a vote of 217 to 203. Mostly parting line, only six Democrats voted yes, two Republicans voted no. The bill now heads to the Senate. The White House opposes it. Wall Street today, the Dow up 235, NASDAQ up 246, S&P up 57. CNBC reports that inflation rose again in February, keeping the Federal Reserve on course to wait at least until the summer before starting to lower interest rates. The Consumer Price Index, a broad measure of goods and services, increased 0.4% for the month and 3.2% from a year ago, the Labor Department Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Tuesday. The monthly gain was in line with expectations, but the annual rate was slightly ahead of the 3.1% forecast from the Dow Jones consensus. And excluding volatile food and energy prices, the core CPI rose 0.4% on the month and was up 3.8% on the year. Both were 0.1 percentage point higher than forecast. That was from CNBC. Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Amy Coney Barrett took part today in the Civic Learning Week National Forum held at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Civic Learning Week is hosted by iCivics and, quote, seeks to highlight the importance of civic education in sustaining and strengthening constitutional democracy in the United States. Justice Sotomayor told a story about an experience that taught her about civic responsibility.
When I was at college at Princeton, I read in a local newspaper. I worked in the library. And one of the wonderful things about the library, then Firestone, now it's probably all digital, and I sort of miss the day when I could walk into the beginning space where there were all newspapers laid out. But I would daily go in there and just flip through them. But I read an article about a man from Puerto Rico who had whose plane had been diverted to Newark. And he didn't understand what was going on and was quite upset at the airport. The policeman who intervened didn't have translators available and thought that he was acting in a bizarre manner. They took him to Trenton Psychiatric Hospital. And the newspaper was reporting that it took a week for him to convince someone to call his family so they could come and get him out. And I was so struck by that story that there weren't enough at that time. That's totally changed now. But at that time, that's many years ago, Amy. close to when you were born. But at that time, the hospital had very few Spanish-speaking people, the psychiatric center. And I organized the Hispanic students on campus to once a week go and meet with the patients for a couple of hours and just talk to them, to have some contact in their native language, to assist them with calls, and some of them did ask us to pass messages to family or things of that nature. And Sometimes all we did at Christmas was bring them home-cooked food, and I didn't do that, but friends were good enough to do that. Bring them home-cooked food and play music with them. And I realized that civic engagement is not merely electoral politics. And that's what so many people think of, that civic responsibility or engagement involves being an elected official or a government official in some way. It's not just that. It's something much bigger. It's about every act we do in that small C citizen to help solve a problem that the community has. And that kind of engagement is what I call civic engagement. It is not just electoral or government structure, but community structure, and what we each undertake as individuals to help resolve the difficulties in the world around us.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor at George Washington University at a Civic Learning Week National Forum, and sitting beside her was Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who told a story about living in Louisiana, and she said somehow the local polling station was closed and her family volunteered to use their garage so that people could vote. And that's what she remembers from her childhood. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter word for word and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.